Adam Elliott's devotion to the painstaking art of stop-motion animation and the quietly sweet, funny, offbeat sensibility, full of heart, that he pours into it has won him admiring audiences of millions of people all around the globe. His films are handmade works of art. There's no CGI. Every prop, tier, and special effect is made by hand. In 2004, Adam won an Academy Award for the short film Harvey Crumpet, and he returned to the Oscars again last year when his most recent film, Memoir of a Snail, was nominated for Best Animated Feature Film. Adam Elliott, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Hello, Julian.
Adam, tell us about your early years and the family you grew up in.
Well, I thought I had a pretty normal upbringing until I discovered in my teens that having an acrobatic father wasn't normal. And being raised on a prawn farm in the outback of South Australia wasn't normal either. So, looking back, it was a very colourful early childhood, and I think really was quite formative to what I am today. I really think that's where all the eccentricities and my love of eccentricity began.
What was your relationship with your parents like?
Well, look, you know, Dad was a jack of all trades. He was a well-known vaudevillian, and he and my Uncle Barry were in a duo called the Flying Trapinos. And they were regulars on Graham Kennedy's In Melbourne Tonight as a little comedy duo. I think, you know, today's equivalent would probably be the Umbilical Brothers. So that's what Dad did when he was younger. But back then they didn't limber up as well as they do today. And he did his bap in and had to have a premature retirement from vaudeville. So naturally, when you retire from acrobatic clowning, you move into prawn farming. It's a very long story, but to cut it short, I had very colourful parents. Dad, sadly, no longer with us, but Mum still is. I always cite Mum as one of the funniest people I've ever met, but she doesn't know she's funny, and nor do we want to let her know that either.
What was the household like? Who else was in it?
Well, I had an older brother, younger brother, older sister, and my older brother Luke's an actor. So, you know, creativity was certainly in the family, in the blood. My grandfather was a tombstone engraver. That's where I got my love of handwriting from. It's been great having support and encouragement from parents and relatives who understand the arts. But really, Mum and Dad never pushed me into becoming a filmmaker or even becoming an artist of any variety. They were just really concerned that I had a real job to fall back on. And if anything, they encouraged me to not go into the arts. But of course, that's where I ended up, and I'm very happy where I've ended up.
How did you get on at school, Adam?
Well, look, I was certainly the class clown, no pun intended, having a father as a clown. But I certainly knew from a very early age that to be accepted in the playground, my best strategy was to entertain the others. And so I would find any way, whether it was drawing a funny picture of the teachers or, you know, acting up. It really was a way to get other people to like me. And I think nothing's really changed now that I'm in my 50s. And actually, having a father who was an entertainer, when I graduated from film school, he said, what are you calling yourself again? I said, Dad, I'm an auteur. He said, what's that? It sounds a bit wanky. And I said, no, well, I'm a writer-director. And he said, well, really, it's the same as what I did as a vaudevillian. You're really there to entertain the masses. And he said two things that really resonated, which has stuck with me to today, and that is, I try and do two things with all my films, and that is to make the audience laugh, make the audience cry, which is exactly, he was right. That's what he did as an acrobatic clown. So yeah, having a father that simplified things, didn't let your ego get carried away, and he really kept me level-headed and kept us all down to earth, no matter how fantastical we thought we'd become.
Your films are full of a sense of empathy for people who don't quite fit in, maybe have a sense of being an outsider. Did you have that sense as a young boy?
Oh, for sure. Look, I think, you know, all teenagers go through periods of melancholy and loneliness and feeling like they don't fit in. And I certainly did, you know, as a young closeted gay man, I really felt that I was different and that no one understood me. But again, I managed to survive, and you know, I was very lucky. I didn't really suffer any bullying or teasing. I went to a great school, Halebury College here in Melbourne, and they had a great art and drama department. So I, you know, I found my people who were like-minded, and again, was very lucky that I was supported and validated by what I wanted to do.
You mentioned drawing as part of your class clown act. When did you start drawing every day?
Yeah, well, look, you know, as a little kid, like most kids, you draw, and then usually by around the age of 8, for some reason, kids stop drawing. I think it's because their drawings, they're trying to get them to look realistic. But I was born with a physiological tremor, so I shake, and I still do today. And my mother has this, my grandfather had it. So my drawings are always a little bit wobbly and asymmetrical and naive looking. And I just kept going. I didn't stop drawing. And as an adult, I realized that drawing is my form of yoga. It's really where I go into this other happy place, this other zone. Some people call it the flow. And I certainly can relate to that because you know, time stands still. I don't know, it's very calming, soothing. And I still draw every day. And actually, that's how I start my day. I don't go straight to social media or the news. I don't depress myself. I go straight to my pencil and paper and start sketching. And that really gets my creativity flowing. I get a sense of clarity. So, you know, as a young person, I really didn't realize, but what I was doing all those years ago was a form of mindfulness, as we call it today. And I think, you know, people say, what are you going to do when you stop making films? I said, well, I'm doing it now. It's drawing. I'll just keep drawing till the day I drop dead. Yeah.
Your characters have a beautiful and identifiable style to them. If we went back to the Adam Elliott drawings of, say, a teenager, would we see that there already?
Absolutely, yes. I always have been attracted to people who, like myself, feel like they are different or that they don't fit in. Even the films I watch always are about the anti-hero, about people who are misunderstood, marginalized, have some, you know, fundamental flaw that others don't appreciate. So even back then, yes, you know, I was always drawing the elderly. I loved wrinkles. I was always giving old men ear hair and baldness and sunspots. It wasn't that I was into the grotesque, but I really loved imperfections. And I suppose that has carried through with all my films, is that I celebrate people who are perceived as imperfect. And if there is a message or moral to my films, it's about not only accepting your own flaws and imperfections, but other people's as well. So it's taken many decades for me to be conscious of all this, but I think all those drawings and things I was making out of plasticine and all those things I did in my early years really have led to this place where I am today, which is making films about the lonely, the misunderstood, and the melancholic.
When did you start getting into animation?
Well, it's funny because I didn't have a burning ambition to be an animator. I certainly didn't think I'd end up being a stop motion animator, which basically means that all our characters, props and sets are real objects. You know, I often cite Wallace and Gromit as an example of what stop motion is, but it's been around as long as cinema has, very popular in Eastern Europe. The Czechs love stop motion. There's a wonderful Czech animator called Jan Švankmajer who does these wonderful surrealist abstract animations. But, you know, as a kid, I wasn't even into comic books. I certainly watched cartoons like every kid does, but it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I finally stumbled and fumbled my way into film school at the College of the Arts here in Melbourne that I fell in love with stop motion, because I realized it was a culmination of all the things I love. I love telling stories. I love drawing. I love making things, cinematography, music. You know, cinema is a culmination of all these different art forms combined. And I think what I discovered too was that I got to play God. I got to be master of everything, a megalomaniac, a control freak. And I think most animators would say something similar, is that you have this absolute creative freedom and control, and we don't have to worry about actors having tantrums, and we don't have to worry about shooting out in thunderstorms. You know, everything's controlled in one building, and our characters can look however we want them to look. And that's very appealing, and it's a very satisfying art form. It's very slow, obviously. It's very expensive, therefore. but there is something incredibly alluring about it, which is why I think most animators would call themselves obsessive.
Our guest on The Year That Made Me is Academy Award winner Adam Elliott, and he's just told us about stumbling and fumbling his way into the College of the Arts and to animation. What were you doing between school and that stumble and fumble into the arts?
Well, I was 25 when I went to the VCA, and before that, you know, I really had dabbled in all sorts of things. But to cut a long story short, I ended up down at the St. Kilda Esplanade Craft Market selling hand-painted T-shirts. And I was there for 5 years, and I hand-painted every single T-shirt. I didn't mass produce them with silk screen or anything like that. I had a little brush, and I would hand-paint these little witty cartoons on T-shirts. My most popular design was Murray the Tap Dancing Dim Sim. And for some reason, German backpackers loved that T-shirt. And I put them in little brown pizza boxes with the lid cut out, sold them for $25. So I did that for 5 years, every Sunday. And it was very, you know, it was a great career, great lifestyle. But all my friends started graduating from university and becoming doctors and lawyers. And they would come down and sort of patronize me and pat me on the head. And so one day I thought, well, this is getting a bit monotonous. Maybe it's time to move on. And my brother had just graduated from the VCA acting stream. And he said, I think you should go to the College of the Arts and become an animator. You can draw. I'm sure that's a prerequisite. So off I went, and I was very naive. And actually, I didn't get into the VCA. When I went for my interview, they looked at my T-shirts and they said, is this it? You haven't even demonstrated you can try animation. I hadn't done anything other than the T-shirts. And so I didn't get in. But one of the lecturers was the great late Sarah Watt, who saw potential in me. And even though I didn't get in, I got a phone call a few weeks later to say that they saw that I had potential, and one of these successful applicants had decided to drop out and I was next on the waiting list. And so did I want to become an animator? And I remember saying, that's fantastic, but I just enrolled in a picture frame making course at the Council for Adult Education in Flinders Street, because I thought maybe I could become a picture framer and frame my own photographs or something and sell those instead of T-shirts. So I said, look, I'm really sorry. I don't think I can accept this wonderful offer because I've got this picture frame making course. So to cut a long story short, I eventually went to film school. And you know what? All these years later, this person came up to me at one of my talks and she said, do you know who I am? And I said, no. And she said, I'm the one who dropped out and gave you your place at the College of the Arts. And I said to her, you know what? If you hadn't have done that, I doubt I would have reapplied, and I doubt I would have gone to film school, and I doubt I would have won, you know, an Academy Award. So, and I said to her, why did you drop out? And she said, I just wanted to go to RMIT, the other university down the road. So, you know, animation wasn't a burning ambition. And I always say this to students, you know, sometimes you're just in the right place at the right time and you never know where life's going to take you.
You made a trilogy of short films called Uncle, Cousin and Brother. Adam, I'm going to go out on a limb and ask you, were these films influenced by your family?
Well, yes. Look, I certainly don't make documentaries, but yes, every film I've made, all seven of them now, based on my family and friends and people I've encountered along the way. And I do that because I have got a very extended family. I've got a lot of cousins and uncles and aunties, and they're all very colourful and eccentric. But also, you know, I think to create characters that are very authentic, universal and archetypal, you really do have to draw on real life. And of course, that's where the best stories come from. So I do. I base every film on real people. And yes, Uncle, Cousin and Brother, particularly Cousin's my favourite of that trilogy, because that's based on my cousin who was born with cerebral palsy. And as a kid, he was my playmate. I'd go around to his house and he was very courageous. He was always defending me when the local bullies would try and bash us up in the playground, and he broke one of their fingers once. And even to this day, he's still a close friend and relative. And so, yeah, they're all real people. And my family certainly gets nervous whenever I start a new screenplay.
Yes, well, I was going to ask you whether there are any members of your family who have not become closer through your filmmaking exploits.
Well, actually, the funniest one was my first feature, Mary and Max, which starred the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman and Toni Collette. it opened the Sundance Film Festival, and Mum and Dad came along and were in the audience, but they had no idea that they were about to appear in the film. And in that film, my poor father, he dies suddenly. He's metal detecting, and a tidal wave comes and takes him away. And so, you know, I'm quite cruel to my family and friends, but they know that these are embellishments and it's no real critique of who they are as people.
Adam, who is Harvey Crumpet? And can you speak a little bit about Adam Elliott's relationship with him?
Well, I think Harvey Crumpet certainly is my alter ego, or, you know, Harvey is an extension of my own psyche, I suppose. Harvey has perpetual bad luck. That film was narrated by Jeffrey Rush, who did a great job really making Harvey seem very tragic and pathetic at times. And he certainly has a series of bad luck, but ultimately triumphs. And I think Harvey, of all my characters, is the one that probably resonates the most with people, because I think they see themselves in Harvey. I think we've all fallen downstairs in front of people. We've all slipped on banana peels. You know, like, we've all been embarrassed at some point in life. Harvey's not a hero. He's certainly just an everyday person, but he certainly is a character that has been understood by people in Sweden and Japan. And I still get letters and emails every week from people who've just discovered Harvey 20 years later and identify with him. And this is the weird thing, Julian, is that, you know, these are little blobs of clay. And to this day, it still fascinates me that people suspend their disbelief, watch one of my animated films, and for an hour and a half or 20 minutes, they give over and they believe that these blobs of clay have a heartbeat and a soul. And to me, that's, you know, it's magical. And I think stop motion has that quality over other types of animation. The audience can see the fingerprints on the clay, and they know that these are just blobs of clay. It's the same sort of clay they played with as kids. But for some reason, they let go and they suspend their disbelief. And it's a weird ambition to have, but I really do want the audience to be an emotional wreck by the end of one of my films. A bit sadistic, but I want the audience to shed a tear if possible. I certainly want to make them laugh, but if they can leave that cinema having been moved, then I see my job as done. And I think every filmmaker wants that. They want the audience to be connected. They want the audience to be engaged. But they want that emotion. They want the audience to empathise with these characters.
What you ended up with in Harvey Crumpet is a 23-minute tragicomedy in claymation. How long and what did it take to get it on screen?
Well, speaking of tragic characters with bad luck, I mean, I had a lot of bad luck making the film. By the end of the film, I was broke. We'd run out of money. My partner had dumped me. I was depressed. I had to go on unemployment benefits. I had to move back home with Mum and Dad, which, you know, in your 30s, that's a bit embarrassing. So my own life really did start to mirror poor old Harvey's. And I was very despondent at the end of making the film, and we had very low expectations. It's a very long, short film. It really doesn't have a plot. It's just a case study of this tragic old man. And little did we know that it would resonate all around the world. And within 6 months, we'd won all these prizes at film festivals. Then we got shortlisted for the Oscars. Then we got nominated. And we were up against Disney, Pixar and Fox, and they all had short films that cost millions of dollars. Our budget is what they would have spent on catering. So it certainly was this David and Goliath scenario. And even my mum said we had no chance of winning. So then to win the Oscar was a complete shock, and it really took a long time to adjust. And of course, I lost my anonymity, and you know, it really did change my life. But I look back now and I realize the reason Harvey did win was because of our story, and it wasn't about the budget or how well the animation was done. It was a good Aussie yarn, a good story well told that the rest of the world seemed to engage with, and certainly wasn't deliberate. It was all a wonderful accident.
And the Oscar goes to Harvey Crumpet, Adam Elliott.
Wow. Harvey Crumpet has been a film that's been in my head for over 10 years, and I'm so glad he's out. We'd like to congratulate everyone in Australia who helped Harvey come to life. Finally, we'd like to thank two very, very special people, my friend Juliet and my beautiful boyfriend Dan. Thank you.
And that Oscar win was in 2004. Adam, is that the year you've chosen as the year that made you?
I would have to say so, Julian. You know, I did think deeply about this, and, you know, it is a shame that it was an award ceremony in another country. Having been to the Oscars, you know, it's all a big optical illusion. All those giant Oscars on stage are made of polystyrene and, you know, and it's a TV show. And it's a wonderful TV show, and it certainly really supports and encourages cinema. It's a very important annual award show, but nevertheless, it's weird that sometimes you have to leave your own country to feel validated and feel that this weird art form that you've chosen to pursue actually has some worth. And so I certainly came back from the Oscars feeling very buoyant, feeling very validated, and certainly more inspired to keep going, because I certainly didn't think after Harvey I would make another film, because it had really exhausted me mentally, financially. But yeah, so it did change my life. It meant that I was able to make my first feature film, Mary and Max, which did very well as well. And there's that saying, you're only as good as your last film. And I've been very lucky that all seven films have had a degree of success that really has opened the doors to the next film. And I always use the example that the Oscar is a wonderful thing, but the best thing about the Oscar is that it's a golden crowbar. And it certainly helps open doors and gives you opportunity. So for that, I'll be, you know, eternally grateful to the Academy. I am now a member of the Academy as well, and I'm about to vote in all the categories coming up for this year's Oscars. So it's been a wonderful honour, a wonderful privilege, but I can't imagine what I'd be doing now had that little golden naked man not entered my life.
And I gather that when you got back to Australia from the Oscars, there was a bit of mail for you. Can you tell us what was in the postbox?
Well, yeah, the first couple of weeks I used to love going down to the letterbox each day and pulling out these big wads of letters and cards from all these, you know, Australians who wanted to congratulate us. We felt like we were the only Australians at the Olympics that year. So there were long lost primary school teachers and relatives I never knew I had. And it was great reading all these letters. But I think it was the third or fourth day on the big pile of letters and cards. The first two looked very official. And I opened the first one, and it was from the Prime Minister of the time, John Howard. And he had written, it was just a couple of sentences, on behalf of Australia, Mr. Elliott, you've made us very proud. Yours sincerely, John Howard, Prime Minister. I thought, wow, that's amazing. I hadn't even voted for him, and yet he was sending me this wonderful letter. So, of course, my ego inflated, and I looked down at the next letter, and this one looked very official as well, and I opened it up. And this one was from Centrelink to say, dear Adam, congratulations on your Oscar. By the way, you have been cut off the dole. You did not put in your job seeker diary. And I was meant to go to a seminar, which was what to wear to a job interview and how to write a resume. So the irony was, yeah, the day we won an Oscar, I was actually on unemployment benefits or the dole, and I got cut off.
But you then were able to go through life with what you've described as the golden crowbar. I'm assuming that winning an Oscar must bring all sorts of crazy opportunities. What are some of the least Adam Elliott opportunities that have come your way and that you've rejected because of the crowbar?
Well, look, I think for the first couple of months I was on every TV show. I remember doing Burke's Backyard with Don Burke, the Burt Newton show, you know, and look, it was a lot of fun and I really enjoyed all this attention, but then it all settled down and I was able to get on with things. But what did start happening was, of course, because we'd beaten Disney, Pixar and Fox. I mean, one of the films was a film that Walt Disney himself and the artist Salvador Dali had begun making 30 or 40 years earlier, called Destino. It was this collaboration. But unfortunately, Disney and Dali didn't get along. The film never got completed. They then died. And then in early 2000, Roy Disney, who was the head of Disney, then decided to finish this film in honour of his uncle Walt. So that's who we're up against. And of course, we suddenly had agents and suddenly all these offers started coming in for me to direct big Hollywood animated features. And look, they were very well paid and very enticing, but my heart just wasn't in it. I knew that the reason Harvey had won was because it was an Australian story. It was an underdog story. And I knew I had more personal stories to tell. I had more friends and relatives to mine. So we decided to decline all these wonderful offers and come back to Australia and make my first feature, Mary Max, which I'm glad I did. I mean, there were certainly days where I thought, Adam, you're an idiot. You should be doing that so-and-so film. But I'm glad I did because not many Australian feature films get made these days. We are constantly smothered by American content. And, you know, I think Australians are good storytellers and the rest of the world, you know, they see us as quite exotic. We don't make big hits as often as we'd like to, but the big hits we have made, Crocodile Dundee, Muriel's Wedding, Priscilla, audiences around the world love Australian cinema. I mean, even films like Chopper and Romper Stomper, you know, they... Even today when I travel, I get people come up to me and say how much they love Australian cinema. So I often call myself a self-appointed storyteller for our culture, and I'm glad I've remained here. Yes, I'd probably be a lot wealthier if I'd have taken those offers overseas, but I'm glad I've stayed here. I mean, I get to employ my crew, my friends, fellow artists here in Melbourne, and give them opportunities too, because animation's a very expensive, difficult art form to break into. So it's been great now that I'm in my 50s to be able to help emerging talent get into the industry.
You'd obviously put your heart and soul into making Harvey, and you'd had some really, really tough times that you've spoken about in getting Harvey onto the screen. That became a pivot point in your life. You've had incredible creative opportunities since then. What have been the hardest times in your life post-Harvey?
The tough moments have really been being so far away from the rest of the world, particularly the big animation community overseas. You do feel at times full of self-doubt. You certainly go through periods of feeling like you're an imposter, a fraud. Particularly when I'm writing. Writing is a very lonely process, and you do go through periods of self-doubt, particularly when you're writing comedy and tragedy. You're writing a joke that someone may not laugh at for several years and, you know, might cost millions of dollars to make that film and make that film work. So, yeah, I think the writing part of the process is where I tend to, at times, want to throw in the towel. And I certainly there have been those moments where I thought, gee, Adam, you've picked a very tough art form. Why aren't you a ceramicist or a portrait painter or, you know, something a lot easier, quicker and cheaper? But I think stop motion, it is a wonderful art form. It's still appreciated despite, you know, the arrival of AI. And of course, so many artists and filmmakers are worried about AI, but I'm not. I think when I left film school all those years ago, I was told that I was pursuing a dying art form, and that CGI animation would kill stop motion. And of course, you know, we heard that when videotapes came out. And, you know, but the thing is, like, even this year, they're saying 2026 is the year analog is back. And I've just come back from Japan, and you go into secondhand stores and audio cassettes are now popular, not just LPs, but audio cassettes. Apparently knitting has never been as popular. All the art forms that involve making things with your hands. And I think that's partly to do with a reaction to AI, but also people are remembering how good analog was, and digital is here to stay. But I think if we can get a balance between the traditional art forms and the new art forms, then that'll be great. We certainly use digital cameras and computers, but everything in front of our cameras has been handmade. And I think that's what audiences really appreciate about stop motion is, are the fingerprints on the clay, which is why we don't digitally remove the fingerprints. We leave the fingerprints there to prove that what you're looking at is real.
The maker's mark is there. One of the things that really struck me in Memoir of a Snail is the extraordinary complexity of some of the shots that you pull off, these big sweeping camera angles, and knowing that every single thing there is real really does boggle the mind. What would you say is the most technically demanding piece of stop motion animation that you have undertaken, and do you have plans to try and top it?
Yes, well, as you say, Julian, everything you see in one of my films has been handcrafted. Even, you know, the fire, we use yellow cellophane. All the tears in the film, we actually use sexual lubricant. It's a wonderful stuff for making tears and water. Cigarette smoke is cotton wool, so everything is real. But I think the most challenging shot would have been the opening shot of Memoir of a Snail, where the camera goes through this very long tracking shot for a minute and a half. It's sort of my version of the famous shot in Goodfellas, where Scorsese gets the camera to go down in through the restaurant. So it was very ambitious. It took a month to make. It cost $50,000 just for that one shot. I think the whole film cost $7 million, but that one shot cost $50,000. And yeah, it was worth it. It's very overwhelming because the film's about a hoarder. And of course, we wanted the audience right from the get-go to feel the claustrophobia and the density of being a hoarder. So yeah, we had a lot of fun with that. And you know, sometimes you bite off more than you can chew and shots don't work. They fail for whatever reason. But I think, you know, being a filmmaker, being a director is about taking risks, and you're often talked out of things, but I stick to my guns, and, you know, you got to stick to your vision and cross your fingers.
What's next for Adam Elliott?
Well, I've just finished writing the next feature, and it's a road film. I've always wanted to tell an Australian road film. I suppose it's a cross between Thelma and Louise and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I think I love road films because, you know, the protagonist encounters so many eccentrics and unusual people along the way. So yeah, we've just finished writing, and it's now time to finance. We need, I think, $30 million, you know, which is, I mean, everyone says, what's the toughest part of making an animated feature? And I said, well, look, it's not the animation, believe it or not. It's raising the millions of dollars we need. But well, look, we're very lucky here in Australia, Screen Australia, Film Victoria, they've all supported me over the years. And we have to remind ourselves, you know, in America, they don't have government support for filmmaking. We sort of follow the European model, and we have wonderful rebate schemes here too. So, you know, it's one of the reasons I stay here is because it's a wonderful environment to make cinema. And that's why so many Hollywood films get made in Australia as well. There's tax breaks, of course, but also it's a great lifestyle. It's much easier to make a film here than it is in Hollywood.
Adam, it's been delightful speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Julian.
And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us and why?
I have chosen a piece called Eliza's Aria by Australia's most famous classical composer, Elena Katsuchernan, who coincidentally composed all the music to Memoir of a Snail. She's become a great friend. I don't use the word genius very often, but she is. She really is an incredible artist and composer. And this piece, Eliza Aria, is so evocative, so emotive, and it's one of my all-time favourites.
Here it is, Eliza's Aria, and Adam Elliott, thank you once again.
Thanks, Julian.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.